Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's all things political, and we're going to talk a great deal about who in the world is going to enter the Republican presidential race. Chris Christie all over the place last week, and we will be talking about him. We'll be looking at the vulnerability of the president. We will talk about this joint committee created by the debt ceiling agreement. What they are looking at is they try to cut $1.2 trillion from the federal deficit. What's happening with the president jobs program? Ken Rudin is our guest, NPR political editor, daily blog writer of Political Junkie. And of course, I hate to say it, but we'll have to talk a little baseball because it's hard to believe, but Ken, of all things, is a diehard Yankees fan. And this really does appear to be a Brewers year. I'm thinking Brewers Detroit. He may disagree. So we'll start with that. Here's our phone number as we talk about all things political this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Talk@wpr.org. Hello, Ken.
Well, Kathleen, first of all, I grew up in a small town called the Bronx, so I really don't have much of a choice.
Well, all right.
I'm not a front runner. I understand, you know, but nobody feels sorry for the Yankees. Have not won the World Series since 2009.
Ken.
I'm sitting here.
Oh, Ken.
Well, see, I know. See, I agree. I'm glad you agree with me, Kathleen.
I feel so sorry for you.
No, look. I love Milwaukee too. I think Aaron and Eddie Matthews and Joe Adcock, they're great, and I hope they do well.
Yeah, right. But who won two games at the playoffs? Who's the hot team right now, I ask you?
I think it happens to be the Milwaukee Brewers.
Thank you very much,
Ken. They look very hot. They absolutely do.
Thank you very much. Well, watch them as they proceed down the road. I've just become this huge fan. I did have a chance to go to one of the games over the weekend, and it's exciting to go one of these playoff games. It's just everybody is looking at everything that happens. It's just everybody's waving the flags. It's terribly exciting.
Well, what happened last week on that surreal day when basically all the teams' decisions to get them into the playoffs were made within hours, within minutes of each other. When Baltimore came back and beat the Boston Red Sox, when Tampa Bay beat the Yankees, when all these teams suddenly made these moves within minutes of each other to get in the playoffs. It was an unbelievably surreal day, and it's sort of like the Republican battle for the Republican nomination for president.
Yeah, right. Well, let's talk about that, as long as it's all things political. What is this story with Chris Christie? Obviously, the Republicans must not be very happy because there was so much excitement about the fact that maybe he will run.
Well, I don't know if it's just dissatisfaction with Mitt Romney, but from the beginning of this year, it always seemed like the Republicans are looking for somebody else. They know that President Obama's numbers are down. They know that the economy is not doing well. They know that the president seems beatable. We hadn't said that for a long time, but now he certainly seems beatable in 2012, and they don't want to lose this opportunity, but they're not satisfied that Mitt Romney is a true conservative, a true believer, because he has had a tendency to switch positions over the years. So they keep looking for new saviors. They went for Michelle Bachmann for a while after she won the Iowa straw poll. That lasted for all of 15 minutes. Then when Rick Perry got in the race, they thought, oh, this is the greatest thing. But between uneven debate performances and criticisms about his past, he seems to be fading. And now Chris Christie, who's not really a conservative, but he talks tough to the unions. He's balanced the budget. He's refused to raise taxes. And for a guy to be so combative and angry, and this is exactly what the Tea Party loves, with the kind of the mindset of the Tea Party and the fact that things are, in Washington are not working and we need somebody who can just express their anger.
Do you think we should be paying attention to whether or not he's fat?
You know something, that's a fair question, and of course you can't help but notice it. It's a tough thing talking about weight, and I know that although NPR has a show about that, it's called Weight, Weight, Don't Tell Me. It's all about Christie's weight. No, it's not a good joke.
Right.
But a lot of people are just focusing on it. You can't help but notice it. But I remember Barbara Jordan, the late congresswoman from the state of Texas, on the House Judiciary Committee, who was beloved by everybody who knew her. It was a magnificent voice.
Yes.
She was, but do we talk about weight? I don't know. I don't think that's the issue here, but people do talk about it.
Yeah, they do. Well, they wonder, as people mentioned Obama's smoking habit, too. Several reporters were on him, whether or not you can withstand the rigors of a campaign these days, which is just excruciatingly exhausting, I understand.
Well, yes, and it's even more exhausting now and more excruciatingly exhausting now because all the states are moving up. It looks like Iowa and New Hampshire may be the first week of January 2012, as it was in 2008. And so for Chris Christie to make up his mind, I mean, he has less than 3 months to raise a ton of money to get his organization together in states like Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, South Carolina, the early states. And for the most part, you know, the people who are telling him to run are the people who pushed Rudy Giuliani to run in 2008, and we know how well that worked out.
Right. So how vulnerable is the president, Ken?
Well, you know, I mean, if it is, as James Carville famously said, it's the economy stupid. The economy is not doing well. And, you know, just as the economy helped bring down Jimmy Carter in 1980 and George H.W. Bush in 1992, it has put President Obama in a very vulnerable position. There's 9.1% unemployed. There's 16 million people out of work, many millions more trying to find work and not finding anything or having given up completely. And, you know, you could talk about all the foreign policy victories and the strikes against al-Qaeda and things like that. But if you're, you know, if you're hurting in the pocketbook, if your financial future is risky and tenuous, you know, al-Qaeda, al-Shmaider, basically what you need to know is that, you know, you have some kind of income coming in. And if there's some hesitancy about it, if there's some doubt about it, you blame the parties in power, and that's the Democrats.
Right. The president has a new message. He really is on his jobs program now. It really is, in some ways, a new Obama. Why are we seeing this, and will it be effective for him? And is there any chance at all that his program or part of his program will come to fruition?
Well, let me take the latter part first. First of all, my guess is no. I think that for the most part, when the president says that we have to make sacrifices, we do have to cut programs and entitlement programs, but we also have to change. We have to have the rich pay their fair share, pay taxes. That is a no-brainer, a non-starter for the Republicans. House Speaker John Boehner has said as much, and so I suspect that it's less a plan to really get Congress to get something done than it is to rally his base and to make this a campaign, the 2012 campaign, a distinction between the Democratic and Republican philosophies. Not every Democrat is on board either. There are, like, Mary Landrieu in Louisiana doesn't like the thought of taxing oil refineries, things like that, because she has her own constituency down there to begin with. So not every Democrat is on board, but for the longest time, many progressive Democrats were saying that he's being professorial. He's staying out of the battles. He's above the fray. He's got to roll up his sleeves and start to fight. And that's exactly what President Obama has been doing the last couple of weeks.
Is he listening to new advisors?
Well, the problem is, and we've seen some books out. Ron Suskind's book
right.
is one of the good examples. He listens to all his advisors, and one of the problems seems to be is that he's just, you know, he lets the White House become a debating society, that everybody seems to have different solutions of what needs to be done, and he doesn't seem to be as, well, you know, as affirmative on some of these suggestions that are being brought out. So he seems to be stronger than before. He seems to have decided on a course to take his presidency and his reelection chances in one direction. And again, as I said, for many Democrats, it's not a moment too soon.
Ken, give us an update on this joint committee that's looking at ways to cut at least $1.2 trillion from the federal deficit. What are they doing right now? What's their deadline?
Well, the deadline is coming up pretty soon. And again, if they don't act, there will be automatic cuts in spending. And, of course, the idea was always that, you know, this is a perfect example, a perfect opportunity to show that Washington works. But as we've seen from statements by the leaders of both parties, the Democrats are not about to, you know, make drastic cuts in entitlement programs like Medicare, Social Security, without corresponding tax corresponding tax increases on the rich. And the Republicans are saying that, you know, we weren't elected to raise taxes. The reason Washington is in such trouble is that we're spending beyond our means, and that's where the remedy should lie. So I'm not sure that they're any closer to what they were during the debt commission the debt ceiling battles that Republicans in the White House went through last month. Ultimately, it just seems like it's just, again, more passing the buck. But right now, I think I just know that people just sit back and watch what Washington is doing and saying, you know, these guys can't get their act together.
Yeah. There was more news killing other members of Al-Qaeda over the weekend and some controversy about how that was done.
Well, the fact is that the Obama administration basically targeted an American-born American citizen who is in Yemen working for Al-Qaeda. Now this is, of course, similar to what the Bush administration was planning to do for the longest time. But, you know, ultimately, if you look at the scorecard, you see that, you know, Osama bin Laden is gone. You see this person, this American citizen in Yemen has been killed. You could say, well, this is a great victory in the war on terror. Others say, well, this, you know, targeting American citizens abroad is pretty difficult to defend. There are a lot of civil libertarians, the ACLU, and people like that are saying that, you know, these people have been targeted and killed and taken out without a fair trial. So I think most of the Americans, the polls show that most of the American people do support the Obama administration in this venture, but there are some questions and some disturbing questions raised by a lot of people.
And what's your assessment, Ken, of how successful we've been in really wiping out Al-Qaeda? Is it a much, much, much less significant threat now?
Well, the thing about Al-Qaeda is that, you know, all you need is one person strapping a bomb to himself or one person deciding to bring down an airplane. And so you don't have, it's not so much that the death of Osama changes everything, changes the anger, you know, for the Islamic extremist. But at the same time, I think it seems like their operations have been disrupted in many places. But at the same, and in the drone strikes in Pakistan are being apparently more and more successful. But you know, there are places in Yemen, and there are more places in Africa. And there are, you know, more and more sanctuaries in Pakistan and Afghanistan, perhaps with the protection of the Pakistani government, that wiping out this terror, this enemy, is not likely to be completely done. But its effectiveness, you know, the Obama administration could still point out that we have not had anything close, anything like a 9/11, you know, in 10 years because of this kind of vigilance.
Yeah. One of the have had a really good string of authors on the last couple of weeks. One of the knock you out books is Dana Priest's book. I don't know if you've had a chance to read it, but unbelievable the whole system that's in place to counter terrorism. I mean, billions and billions. It's huge.
It is, and you know, and when you ask the American people again, there's been a lot of articles in the last few days about this that you know the Obama administration can justifiably talk about their great successes in this international war on terror, and yet when you ask people what they think about, I mean, I think Al-Qaeda and the Taliban and you know the terror threats are not the prime concern of the American people. So, I mean, it's to say that, yes, there have been great successes, but until, you know, I get a job and my family gets a job and my business can thrive, that's all I'll think about. And, again, that's what I'll probably think about when I go to the voting booth in 2012.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Get me a job. Ken Rudin is our guest. We're going to start taking your phone calls, and your subjects are on the Wall Street occupation, job creation in the Obama reelection, and those are just a few of the things coming up from you. Here's our phone number. Our lines are filled, but there will be openings as we carry on here. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Ken Rudin is our guest, NPR political editor, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour number two of our program, the Milwaukee Art Museum, celebrating the 10th anniversary of the Calatrava Design Building, the most beautiful building in the city of Milwaukee, I think, and I think a lot of people would agree with me. The director of the museum and the chief curator will be with us to talk about the building that has attracted so much attention, really, around the world. It is considered by many to be Calatrava's masterpiece. How it was built, why it was built, how you feel when you're inside it. There's just nothing like it. So that's hour number two. Ken Rudin, this hour, off we go to your phone calls. Tom in Milwaukee. Hi, Tom.
Hey, good morning, Kathleen, and good morning, Ken. I have a burning question that's been gnawing on my mind since about September 20th, and that is this whole Occupy Wall Street situation. There's been a virtual media blackout on this story, and I'm wondering why the Main Street media is, or mainstream media, I should say, isn't jumping on this and trying to get at the facts. A Saturday, these protesters supposedly, allegedly took over and marched across the Brooklyn Bridge, and yet I have seen videos out there on the internet where the police are very clearly leading the protesters across the bridge. They're not trying to stop them. They're leading them. And then when they get halfway across, they start arresting people. And I think there's a lot of civil rights abuses going on, and I'd be interested in your comments on that, Ken.
Well, Tom, you're absolutely right. For the longest time, there was a complete media, I don't know if blackout is the right word, but there was nothing covered about what was going on. And initially, all we were talking about were a few dozen college students who were deciding to spend day and night in this park near Wall Street. But as it got more and more attention, and perhaps not from the mainstream media, but more and more attention was put on more and more, hundreds and hundreds of people were showing up. And as you say, that's exactly right. There were hundreds of people who tried to shut down the Brooklyn Bridge, and the cops did try to walk them off the bridge because you just don't, you can't, you know, you, by stopping traffic on the bridge, you disrupt all of traffic in lower Manhattan, and then a lot of them were arrested. A lot of it is about, it's not so much a simple anti-capitalism campaign. It really is talking about the undue influence of money on everything, and Wall Street is the obvious target. Now, for the longest time, there was very little coverage, very little media coverage, but then more and more celebrities would throw their weight behind it. Alec Baldwin did something, on Twitter that basically was posting videos about what was going on, then more and more people were showing up. So the coverage is increasing. I don't know ultimately what the goal is, except to make the point that money is just ruling everything and controlling everything. But I suspect that you're going to see much more coverage because more and more people are a part of these protests.
Somebody, I can't remember who, made the point over the weekend, maybe many people did, that this could be the beginning of a progressive Tea Party.
Well, you know something, that's a good point. And I think the problem has always been is that it's always good, not it's always good, it's always more likely to have a Tea Party when the other side is controlling the government. In other words, with Barack Obama in the White House, a Tea Party on the right makes sense. Now, when you have Barack Obama in the White House, it's hard to have any organized part of the left because ostensibly President Obama and the Democrats should be part of that coalition. But clearly, if corporations are still doing this in business as usual, if Wall Street is still, you know, progressing and the banks are progressing as always, what does it matter who's in the White House? And I think that's basically what these protests are trying to accomplish.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Tom, for your call. Jim in Milwaukee. Hi.
Yes, hi. Want to try to hit a couple things today if I can squeeze them in. And I hope that people will grab a piece of paper so that they can jot down some ideas so they can email and network both in and out of state. And just picture, and you could include this on your email, picture Willard Romney and his beach house coming up with a GOP economic plan. And the economic plan would be a gold mine for the rich and the shaft for the rest of us. This was a concept that was used by Bill Clinton successfully in the 1990s and I think should be repeated. And you, in addition to putting it out in email, I would suggest that people get that in paper form also and go to the cheapest place they can find to photocopy it. and then go a few blocks from your home and put it out door to door for people. And finally, I'd just say that people ought to take a look also at the moral picture, which was talked about a little bit by Bill Maher this weekend. He was saying in a satirical way that if the Republicans nominated Jesus for president, he wouldn't last long on the ticket because he'd advocate feeding the poor, which is a welfare program. He'd want to heal the sick, which would be providing healing free and without the insurance company middleman. And also that, of course, the meek couldn't inherit the earth because that would involve an inheritance tax. And besides, he was born overseas and with no birth certificate, unlike Obama.
Ken.
It is a fun picture, but you know, but sad at the same time. But I'll say one thing about what Jim said is that look at what happened during the recent Republican debate where Rick Perry was trying to defend the fact that children of illegal immigrants, undocumented immigrants in Texas were paying in-state tuition to go to college, and he got booed there. And, you know, once upon a time, you know, we heard George W. Bush in 1999 talk about compassionate conservatism. The compassion seems to be gone from a lot of the, from at least a lot of the candidates running for president. There was a mention of a gay soldier who served in Iraq and he was booing on stage.
Mm-hmm.
Herman Cain said the other day that he regretted not speaking up. But there's one thing to have conservative philosophy, and there's one thing to say that, you know, government spending is getting out of control and something has to be changed. But when you lose the compassion angle, when you start booing a gay soldier, or when you start cheering the fact that Rick Perry, you know, there were 234 executions under his leadership as governor of Texas, and you cheer that, something seems wrong. I'm not attacking Republican philosophy. I'm just attacking a sense in this country that if you're down and out, it's your fault and you deserve it. And it just seems like that politics has fallen to a level that we've never seen before.
How about this Alabama immigration law? People are just taking their kids out of school.
It is part of what's going on. You have a very conservative governor in Alabama. You've seen attacks on any kind of. Once upon a time, as we said, George W. Bush and John McCain were talking about a legal path to citizenship for people in the country.
Sure.
Illegally, and that is just not. That's just not part of the dialogue for 2012, and so you know you're going to see it. 2012 is going to be a huge choice here between two variant political philosophies, and I kind of think that while a lot of people say that the Democratic Party has moved further to the left than ever before, of course others say that President Obama is hardly a left winger, but the Republican Party has moved far to the right on issues that the Republican Party used to stand for. I mean, it was the party of Lincoln. It was the Republicans who helped pass, shepherded the Civil Rights Bill in 1964. And yet those days seem like, you know, a million years ago.
Thank you, Jim. I always appreciate your Monday calls. Fred in Watersmeet, Michigan, is it, Fred?
Right. We're from Wisconsin Rapids, but we spend spring through fall up here.
Oh, okay.
In the Northwoods.
Great.
Thanks, guys. Another good program. I also have a couple questions that have been gnawing on me. I know in regard to job creation, the Republicans are doing nothing to want to create jobs to prevent Obama being reelected in 2012. I know the corporations are sitting on a ton of cash, and supposedly they're not creating jobs because of uncertainty. But I wonder in my own mind is that they're not wanting to create jobs just like the Republicans so that Obama won't be reelected in 2012 also. And then the second question is, what does Ken think will happen if the Republicans in 2012 get control of all three branches of the Congress and the presidency with a conservative Supreme Court? What does he think might be passed? And that's my comment.
Thanks, Fred. Thanks for the call.
Well, first of all, regarding the first part of it, there is there is ample evidence that corporations are making, of course, more money than ever, but they are afraid of the uncertain economy. And you're not going to hear coming out of my mouth saying that the reason they're doing this is because they want President Obama defeated. I really think that whether it's right or wrong, I really think these corporations are just scared. And rather than creating jobs, they're hoarding onto the money because the uncertain future. I think that's why people are not spending. The same reason they're afraid of what an uncertain future. What would happen if the Republicans take over all three branches? Well, we did see that after 2000 when George W. Bush was elected president and the Republicans had control of the House and Senate. The thing is, in the Senate, you know, I mean, just as the Republicans have the fact that the Democrats don't have a veto-proof majority in the Senate, well, the Republicans won't have a veto-proof majority in the Senate either. So while, you know, you don't know what's going to come out of the White House and what's going to come out of the House of Representatives, the fact is the Democrats will have at least 40 seats, if not 45 seats, and so that would be the break on any kind of, you know, if your fear is like a right-wing control of government, the Senate minority is probably the best bet of keeping that from happening.
We go next to Scott in River Falls. Hi, Scott.
Good morning. My daughter and I were watching C-SPAN yesterday, and she asked me a funny question. She says, what is a conservative and what is a progressive? And I decided to get out Merriam-Webster and tell her. And what I found was that a conservative is a political party or philosophy that favors the preservation of the status quo and is critical of proposals for change, that they're moderate and cautious. And a progressive is someone that is aiming at or characterized by progress to something better, favoring or characterized by reform or new techniques. And when I listen to the Republican debates and things, I don't see that as conservative. I hear about constitutional amendments and, oh, Michelle Bachmann's going to end all taxation. And I'm wondering why we keep using these labels when they just don't seem to fit at all.
Well, I think one of the reasons the so-called left went from liberal to progressive because it was a better connotation, and liberal just has this ugly word in the American dialogue. But you know, there are people who say that what the conservative philosophy is not what it used to be, that people are talking about changing the way of life that we've had for, you know, hundreds of years with entitlement programs and guarantees from the government. So, I mean, these are your words, not mine, or maybe they're Merriam's words and not mine. But obviously, look, you know, it's like the argument about life, where you can say that, well, am I anti-abortion or am I pro-life? Both have different connotations, but they ultimately mean the same thing. But it just seems like the rhetoric that the argument that a conservative party once stood for is not the same thing. But again, at the same time, when you hear things from Michelle Bachmann, I think it's one more reason why she's unlikely to be the nominee. And I think that's why it seems like the establishment Republican Party is scared to death of a conservative Barry Goldwater kind of debacle, and that's why they seem to be rallying behind Mitt Romney, not because they like him so much, but because he just seems like he's not going to frighten away the vast majority of the American public.
I love the fact that you were watching C-SPAN. You have to be one of...
With his daughter.
Yeah, 10 people in Wisconsin not watching the Packers or the Brewers yesterday, Scott.
Michael Moore was on.
Thanks very much for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. Ken Rudin is our All Things Political guest this hour, NPR political editor. And we go to Glenn in Cedarburg. Hi, Glenn. Hi, Glenn. Are you there? Go ahead. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I just had a couple of comments.
All right.
The first one is, does Ken think that President Obama made him a huge mistake in the early 90 days of his term with the stimulus package? In my view, it should have been a massive public works program on the scale of the CCC or the WPA. And I guess my other comment would be, as I watch these young college protesters and young people in that Wall Street incident and basically nonviolent protests, and the New York police macing them or pepper spraying them, I was wondering that the New York police are pepper spraying the wrong people. They should be pepper spraying the bankers inside.
Well, I think that's what a lot of the demonstrators down on Wall Street would argue too. But I think once you have the tactics going from just police sitting back to pepper spraying, then that just increased the confrontation. I think that's what obviously the protesters want. But I mean, look, they're not going to shut down Wall Street. They're not going to stop the capitalist system. They're not going to stop the influence of money in politics. They are sending a message, but I don't know how effective they could possibly be. But look, you know, once upon a time in 1965, 50 people would protest against the war in Vietnam, and by 1967, there were 500,000 people marching down Fifth Avenue. So obviously, protests start somewhere, and they start small. Regarding whether President Obama should have been more courageous, shall we say, and more adventurous with a larger stimulus package, a job creation thing in the beginning, well, you know, for a while, for a brief shining moment, the Democrats had 60 votes in the Senate, and yet they didn't agree on anything. I mean, basically, for a few months, the Republicans were completely shut out. They had Nancy Pelosi as Speaker of the House. They had 60 votes in the Senate, and yet the Democrats were bickering among themselves. Is it too big? The blue dog is saying this is too much government programs. We can't agree on everything. And by the time the Democrats turned around, Scott Brown had won the Massachusetts Senate race, and their 60 votes were gone. So, history is always like, should they have done this? Should have, woulda, coulda? Perhaps, you know, you could say that rather than focus on so many things at once, perhaps the president should have said, look, jobs is the question, jobs is the problem, and jobs should be the answer, and maybe to go that way. But he didn't have a United Democratic Party behind him, and he certainly doesn't have a United Democratic Party behind him today.
How are people in Massachusetts taking to Elizabeth Warren?
Well, you know something, I mean, there's no question in my mind that is the most vote. I mean, I still think that the Republicans will pick up Senate seats in 2012. Whether they pick up enough seats, they need four to take control of the Senate, or three if the Republicans win the White House. But Elizabeth Warren is running a very good campaign. I mean, the Democrats, the Republicans are saying that she's radical, she's a Harvard intellectual radical, but the latest polls have it like almost dead even. And while Scott Brown is to this day still the most popular politician in the state, this is a very Democratic state. You'll have Barack Obama winning handily in November in 2012, and that's going to be a tough race to watch, a big race to watch. Scott Brown has almost $11 million in his campaign kitty right now, but Elizabeth Warren is doing very well with feminist and progressive groups. That's going to be a really close race to watch.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Glenn, very much for the call. We go next to Matt in Lake Geneva. Hi, Matt.
Hello there.
Hi.
I was listening to the political segment with Neil Conan on Talk of the Nation, where Ken Rudin is featured regularly on Wednesday.
Mm-hmm.
And you had the former Huckabee advisor talking about what his thoughts about the Republican candidates, and talking about how the media, this is the thing that caught my attention, how the media has to want to cover a candidate in order for him to be successful. And then a caller called in and rightfully pointed out that that the media is very blatantly against covering anything about Ron Paul. And I was really surprised at the reaction of Neil Conan and Ken Rudin, who basically said, oh, well, we let you get on the air to talk about Ron Paul, you know, as if kind of that's good enough.
Matt, that's a good point. First of all, I disagreed with that response. The fact that we allow a phone call to come in and talk about Ron Paul does not mean that there's fair coverage of Ron Paul. But what I did say is that, first of all, I think NPR is doing a great job of covering this campaign? No, because we seem to be stuck in the Mitt versus Rick story that everybody else seems to be, and we're ignoring the other eight candidates. But we also did have Ron Paul on the program just a couple of weeks before, where he was talking, you know, and he took phone calls from everybody. I mean, is that making up for the fact that we're focusing for the most part on these two candidates? No. The fact is, I turned on the TV last Wednesday or something, and all three cable stories all had breathless speculation about Chris Christie. Now, I don't think Chris Christie will run, but I mean, we just seem to have 15-minute attention span, where as we go from one story to one story to one story, we beg for Rick Perry to run because it'd be a great story, and then we decided we don't like him anymore. There are candidates like the Newt Gingriches and the Rick Santorums, and the Ron Pauls who have been out there, you know, doing their stuff day in and day out and not getting the attention that they deserve. Now, is a perfect example of what you're saying is Michelle Bachmann won the Iowa straw poll, and everybody went ballistic. Big story, big story. Ron Paul had like maybe 5 votes fewer than Michelle Bachmann, and everybody said, well, you know, Ron Paul always does well in straw polls, so who cares? So I know there is a frustration out there, and to say that we're doing whatever we can is not good enough, but I will tell you that, you know, we make many offers for Ron Paul to come on our programs. He has come on Talk of the Nation in a few weeks ago, and could we do a better job? Absolutely.
Thanks, Matt, for the call. Bud in Saner. Hi, Bud.
Yeah, good morning. Ken, you hit a home run with your comment about President Obama's handling of the economy in a debate society in the White House. That is typical professorial. The man has no competence on the subject. He can't do anything other than listen to debate. And the worst part is, where does he get his decision basis from? You know, he did a similar thing with the military. He listened to a debate society on bringing troops home, and he sided with the debaters, which were not military people. Is this the kind of incompetence we want for the future?
Well, you know, I mean, obviously, if we're looking at President Obama's economic record, not his policy, but his record, it's not a good record. I mean, you know, the debt has jumped tremendously. Unemployment has jumped tremendously. Everybody seems to agree that there's no change in sight regarding the economy. And as we saw, as I said, in Ron Suskind's book, you see that between Tim Geithner, who basically defended the banks before he came, and Wall Street before he came to the administration, and you know, and Larry Summers and all those people, he just listens to the arguments over and over again. They debate, and he said, okay, let's do something. I mean, look, you know, everybody agrees that he's a very smart guy, President Obama. He has a great speaking style, but he was a state senator in Chicago for 8 years, and he was a U.S. senator for 2 years, and here he is becoming president, and everybody said, well, why doesn't he know what to do? And you can make the case, well, why did we ever think that he knew what to do? I think part of the problem was the Republican Party was in power for 8 years, and they clearly didn't know what to do because the whole economic system was collapsing. But if you look at the Obama decision-making process, it's really, you know, it's done by committee, and it's not always satisfactory, and it's certainly not always working.
Ken Rudin is our guest for All Things Political. He is the NPR political editor. You do hear him, as one of our callers suggested, Matt, on Talk of the Nation on Wednesdays, and you hear him other times on NPR. He is a writer of the daily blog Political Junkie, and we're delighted to have him as our guest for All Things Political. Our phone number, one line is open, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our number two of our program, the Milwaukee Art Museum, celebrating the 10th anniversary of the Calatrava Design Building. It is a beauty. We will talk about the international attention that this building has received, how the museum is celebrating with an exhibit on the plans for it and the Calatrava designs, the drawings that are a part of the exhibit. So that should be fun. Hour two of the show this Monday. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. After this truly remarkable sports weekend in the state of Wisconsin, this is a good time to tell you that you could win tickets to see the Packers play the Vikings at Lambeau Field. Go to WPR.org to see the rules and make a donation right now. Your gift will enter you in the drawing, and it will help us reduce our fall pledge drive from 12 days to just 6. Great news for a Monday, right? Give now at WPR.org, and best of luck. Maybe you'll be like my mom, who She was great. She used to enter every contest imaginable, and she won back when I was a little kid. Why I like to shop at A&P in 50 words or less. She did, Ken. She won a trip with Richard Simmons in the Caribbean. She won the Illinois Lottery. She was just and shopping at a grocery store, went a shopping spree for 15 minutes.
I remember back then when A&P merged with Stop and Shop, and it was called Stop and Pee. I don't know if you remember that, but okay, seriously, 1957 and 1958, what do those years remind you of? Yankees Milwaukee World Series. Come on. Let's have it again in 2011.
That would be okay. That would be okay as long as the Milwaukee's in it. That's all right. That's all right.
Yeah.
And remember in that series when Yankees fan called us Bushville? We'll never forget, Ken.
They did?
We will never forget. Yes, they did. We have a picture in our house of that. Yeah. So, it'd be all right. Will you come and see the game?
I will. Boy, would I love to see it.
I'll bet you would. Yeah, I would too. I'm ready for it. We're ready. All right, back to phone calls. Mike in Columbus is next. Hi, Mike.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've heard on this radio station that the richest 10% in this country own 90% of the wealth, and that the richest 1% take home 20% of the annual income in this country. And I guess I'd like to hear your guest comments on whether they think that this is at all sustainable, and if not, how we correct this. I'll take my comment or your answers off the air.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you.
Mike, I don't know the answer to that. I know that, you know, that quote was cited over and over again during the 8 years of the Bush administration, and not that President Obama is going to change all these things within two, three years, but that number is still the same. The rich do control an overwhelming amount of the wealth in this country, and I don't know what the answer is. I don't know how you sustain it. I don't know how you could sustain 9-10% unemployment without something going, you know, something changing drastically in this country. But there seems to be, you know, I don't know what optimism there was. There seemed to be optimism in the 1990s, and that optimism seems to be gone. And I think even among the folks in the Obama administration too, they're saying nothing is going to change anytime soon.
I want to ask about helping people and what it is that Democrats and Republicans can do, and if they're even paying attention to all of these people. You've mentioned it frequently this hour, Ken, who don't have jobs. We just did a show last week on the number of 18 to 29-year-olds who are living at home, who don't have jobs or are really underemployed. It's like they've lost a whole 10 years of their lives as they prepare for careers. Things are really bad for people, and I think that a lot of people are saying nobody's doing anything to help us do what we're prepared to do and we're willing to do. There's a disconnect here somehow.
There is a disconnect, and I don't know what the answer is too. I mean, in the old days, I mean, we almost shut down the government because one side objected to disaster insurance, with the hurricanes and the earthquakes and things like that, and they said,
yes,
well, we'll only pay for it if you take it out of spending from somewhere else. In the old days, that was a given. That was just a knee-jerk reaction that, yes, it was automatic. You have to increase disaster insurance, disaster payments. That's a given. When we have these fights over extending unemployment, nobody wants to be unemployed. Nobody wants to live off the dole, I mean, I don't think. And yet that seems to be like, well, it's not the government's responsibility to protect its people. Now, there are two tremendous different philosophies of government at stake here. We saw this coming out of the election of 2010, and it'll certainly be part of the 2012 campaign, but it just doesn't seem, we seem to be arguing over things that in the old days, you know, everybody was on the same side.
Right. John in Madison, hi. Hello, John.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Hi.
When I was in school, we learned a different term for the Republican agenda. It wasn't conservative, it was reactionary. As I recall, a reactionary is someone who's attempting to bring the conditions back into the past. And if you look at state government, Scott Walker, has ripped up the union rights that existed since the 70s. If you look at the federal level, there's their attempts to remove Medicare and Medicaid that existed since the 60s, and even to at least weaken Social Security that existed since the 30s. I don't know when people are going to realize you don't progress by going into the past. And that's my comment. I guess I'll take any answer off
all right.
Also.
All right. If you want to respond.
Yeah, well, you know, when I was a kid, same thing. I mean, the conservatives were called reactionary and the liberals were called radical. And, you know, that's how both sides saw each other. And I think that's how both sides still see each other. You know, for all the talk about how the Republicans today are reactionary and going into the past, there are Republicans who say that the president is radical and socialist and the government is, you know, just getting too big for its own britches. And that's unsustainable as well. So we don't have – nobody's talking to each other. We are talking at each other. We have cable TV that facilitates – they're talking at each other, and, you know, as John says, how this is sustainable, I don't know, but I see nothing. I see nobody. I see no transformational figure in 2012 or in the near future who is going to come and change that. You know, there's a group called Americans Elect that's saying that between the left, you know, the Democrats on the left and the Republicans on the right, we need a centrist party for a third party to be elected president. And a lot of people are signing on to that. Tom Friedman, the New York Times. To me, we hear this all the time. We hear it. We heard it with Ross Perot in 1992. He had $60 million of his own money. And how many electoral votes did he get? Zero. So we seem to have a system that doesn't allow a third voice in this debate. And yet I would think that with things being so bad, when the two parties not talking to each other, this would be a perfect opportunity for a third voice.
Mm-hmm. Bill is next in Madison. Hi, Bill.
Hello. I suspect that this is like an organized Republican campaign to put this talking point on the air of as many radio talk shows as possible, because I hear a lot of the same phrases repeated almost almost word for word about how Obama was not really qualified to be president in the first place, and they'll cite his lack of experience in this area or that area. I'd like to point out that no president is ever experienced enough. For example, in the military matters, serving in the military is no guarantee that you're going to have, if you've been a private in the U.S. Marine Corps, that doesn't mean you know how to deal with military matters on a strategic or global scale. Probably the only president who's ever been qualified on that level is maybe Dwight D. Eisenhower. All the presidents, Lyndon Johnson, all he'd ever been is a politician pretty much in his entire life. As far as Obama's political expertise, he survived and prospered for years in a state political environment that's as corrupt and cutthroat as any in the United States outside of maybe Texas. And what I look for in a president is somebody who is, one, got some intellectual wattage, unlike some of the dim bulbs we've had in the past, somebody who has some gravitas, courage of his conviction.
All right. Ken.
Well, you know, there's a lot of what Bill says I agree with. I mean, if you think of FDR and the conduct of World War II, and FDR, unlike Nixon and Johnson, I mean, FDR never served in the military, and yet look at how he commanded the U.S. Armed Services during those 4 years of the war. So I agree with that. I'm not saying at all that Barack Obama is not qualified. He certainly is. And I think he is a very smart person who understands big picture stuff as well as minutia. I was only pointing that when the caller came in about, you know, what did he ever do before? I mean, I said, well, look, you know, if you look at the Susskind book, too, there are some people who really feel that he did not anticipate, nobody anticipated this, but he ran for president never anticipating the depth of the problem, and some people say, quoted in the administration, saying he's over his head. But again, is he smart? I think he is. Does he show good judgment? I think he's able to talk about an issue that the American people do understand. but at the same time, he'll give his speech, and nobody will move. He'll give a speech and saying, this has got to change. This can't be sustained. We have to have a new way of doing things. And the next day, nothing changes. The numbers don't change. So I'm not questioning his qualifications. I'm certainly not questioning his intelligence. I do know that for all what he does when he stands in a speech before Congress or a press conference before the American people, the numbers don't seem to move on that, and that surprises me.
Yeah. Ken, thank you so much for being with us. It's always a pleasure to hear you, even if you are a Yankees fan.
It's in my blood. I have no choice, but good luck with the Brewers.
Good luck with the Yankees, Ken.
Thank you. I think I need it more than you do.
All right. Thanks. Ken Rudin, our guest for All Things Political Today, NPR political editor. He writes a daily political junkie blog, and you hear him on Wednesday's Talk of the Nation. And you hear him on NPR frequently talking about politics. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee studios. We have a great hour coming up as we celebrate one of Milwaukee's absolute treasures, beauties. So that's coming up after the news.